Chapter 8. Growing Like a Weed. It's time to start looking for the environmental culprits responsible for the remarkable increase in the rate of autism in California. There's genetics, and there's environment, and genetics don't change in such short periods of time. Irva Hertz Picciotto, a professor at UC Davis's MIND Institute. The prevailing model of autism that has developed over the last few decades depends on epidemiological data for crucial support. Autism has been viewed as a rare, if tragic, disorder, with prevalence rates in most populations around 5 per 10,000. This prevalence rate has been considered constant, with any variations in rates across studies a result of variations in study methodologies and criteria rather than differences in incidence. Consistent with this epidemiological view, and alongside a number of twin studies, autism has been characterized as an inherited disorder with clear, if complex, genetic causes. Despite the fact that few, if any, polygenic diseases have ever been described, the research into autism has proceeded diligently in search of the multiple genes that supposedly cause autism. Autism is therefore grouped together with a host of other inherited diseases, many of which have had well-characterized single-gene loci. Autism thus entered the 1990s as a disease of neurologists and geneticists. The approved therapies, almost exclusively psychotropic drugs and behavioral programs, presumed that the genetic condition was unchangeable, if manageable. To the extent that parents reported puzzlement with a history of apparently normal development, followed by unexplained regression and loss of function, these events were explained away as the progressive consequence of developmental defects. But then, a phenomenon occurred that challenged this perspective on autism. In 2004, Marshallin Yergin Alsop, the CDC's lead autism epidemiologist, gave a presentation on autism outside of Boston that one of us attended. In the course of her lengthy talk, she said something that surprised us. About 10 years ago, we began to hear concerns from around the country that people were seeing more cases of autism, she said. Certainly, the CDC, as the agency on the front line of all emerging public health problems, from HIV to swine flu, would have had some idea that there was an autism problem far before any of the rest of us did. What did the CDC know about the autism epidemic, and when did they know it? A case study in a small New Jersey township offers a revealing glimpse. Stonewalling in Brick Township. The Centers for Disease Control was once a prestigious agency, staffed by an elite corps of disease fighters, manning the front lines of the most threatening health problems of our time. In recent years, riven by dissension, it has failed in many areas to get to the roots of the most critical public health challenges of the day, including, but not limited to, autism. Morale has deteriorated and Congress has been investigating the agency. The CDC has the dual responsibility for monitoring vaccine safety and promoting the vaccine schedule. At the same time, it's also responsible for surveillance on diseases like autism. In light of widespread concern within the autism parent community over the link between autism and vaccines, when the CDC announces that it's launching a new effort to find the cause of autism, parents have been skeptical. Was there a point in the history of autism when CDC leaders had the chance to honor its history and raise the alarm over the autism crisis? From Yergin Alsop's intriguing comment, it's clear that CDC was at least beginning to hear reports of rising autism rates in 1995. There were few signs of a broader recognition of an autism problem that one can find before that. But then, in a small town in eastern New Jersey, the CDC's first chance to raise the alarm appeared. In the fall of 1997, at a parent support group meeting, a few people started commenting about how many new autism cases seemed to be cropping up in Brick Township, New Jersey, and how there seemed to be an unusual number of 3 to 4-year-old children with a new autism diagnosis. One of the attendees at the support group, a mother named Bobby Gallagher who had 2 young children with autism, was struck by this coincidence. She wondered if there might not be a cluster of autism cases in Brick. Perhaps, she thought, there was something in the water. So she resolved to do something about it. She decided to send around a survey to see if she could count the autism cases in all of Brick, a town of some 70,000 people. So as the new 1997 school year began, Bobby Gallagher distributed her survey form everywhere she could think of in town, and in a few short weeks she got a surprising result. Based on the responses to her impromptu survey, she counted more than 40 autistic children in Brick Township alone, and more than 30 who were just 3 or 4 years old. Armed with these results, Gallagher formed a group called the Brick Posse, Parents of Special Services and Education, and organized a meeting at the local library a couple of months later. They contacted the National Alliance for Autism Research, NAAR, who, in turn, invited a number of academic epidemiologists. To a full house at the library meeting, Bobby Gallagher shared her findings. One of the epidemiologists present decided the numbers were disturbing enough to contact the New Jersey Department of Health and Senior Services, who in turn contacted the CDC. In the meantime, the Brick Posse arranged a meeting with their congressman, Representative Chris Smith, who invited them to his office in Washington. Within weeks, a more organized response took shape. Bobby Gallagher received an invitation to another meeting in Washington, this time in then-New Jersey Senator Robert Torricelli's office. Gallagher remembers the meeting vividly, and she was astonished at how quickly plans had emerged. She had expected to play the role of supplicant, pleading with the government officials to take action. Instead, she found a prompt and aggressive action plan being put on the table. In the room that day were representatives from multiple departments within the CDC who had come to the senator's office equipped with a multi-part plan, the first part of which was a prevalence study for Brick Township, an in-depth survey of the town's autistic population that would pick up where Gallagher's survey left off. The CDC had identified a core team of staffers to lead the effort, including Jacqueline Bertrand and Marshallin Jergen Alsop from the National Center on Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities, NCBDDD, and Frank Bove from the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, ATSDR. Their proposal, to diagnose every child with autism in Brick Township between the ages of 3 and 10 years old. They would start canvassing for cases and conducting interviews beginning with the start of the 1998 school year in September. And they planned to move quickly, at lightning speed really, to have their initial results ready by the end of the year. They were true to their word. 2 diagnosticians spent several days a week diagnosing children in the fall of 1998, and by January 12, 1999, the CDC had confirmed the findings of Gallagher's initial survey. Out of an initial estimated Brick population of 6,000 children, from 3 to 10 years old, they had found more than 40 cases of autism, giving a preliminary rate that was 12 times the estimated prevalence in the rest of the country. I think there is a cluster here. I don't know why, the lead investigator said in an article by the Associated Press the next week. If we find it something that can be taken out of the community, that will be done, she said. According to the AP, she also added another intriguing tidbit, that the researchers are eager to solve the puzzle here because of escalating calls the last few years about possible, but less credible, clusters elsewhere in the nation. It all seemed to Gallagher like a dream. The cavalry had arrived, and somehow they were going to get to the bottom of the issue. But then something strange happened. Suddenly, the lines of communication with the CDC team went dark. After several months of intensive planning, intensive collaboration, and rapid response, the CDC team told Gallagher that they were not at liberty to discuss the results with the parents any longer. According to Gallagher, one of the CDC staffers informed her that the mere mention of the word cluster had provoked a reaction from the higher-ups within the CDC. Apparently, there was now even a debate as to whether they could use the word elevated when describing the prevalence rates. So from January 1999 until the release of the final study in April 2000, there was no more interaction with the CDC. Not a single word. Perhaps this was due to concern about the legal questions it raised if there was indeed something in the water. Class action attorneys had begun recruiting local families. Perhaps the BRIC results weren't a cluster after all, but part of a larger pattern that caused a more generalized concern within the CDC. Maybe it wasn't the water after all, since in February 1998, The Lancet had published a controversial study implicating vaccines in autism. But there was no doubt about the silence coming from Atlanta. Something had changed the behavior of the CDC team. Vague political rumors circulated as an explanation for the new sensitivity from the feds. But whatever the cause, it wasn't until well over a year later, April 2000, that the CDC's BRIC study team would resurface. And when they did, all talk of a cluster was gone. All concern expressed in mid-1997 for the surge in 3 to 4 year old kids, who were 4 to 6 years old in 1998, was gone as well. Politics and public relations priorities, it seems, had taken precedence. There was, to be sure, more work to be done after January 1999. The team added more autism cases to its count of over 40, reported in their first press conference. By the time of their final report in April 2000, the CDC had identified 60 cases of autism spectrum disorder, ASD, in a population of just 8,900 children between the ages of 3 and 10. This rate, 1 in 150 children, was the highest autism rate ever reported anywhere in the world up to that time. And Bobby Gallagher believed the CDC's count left out quite a few families that had left BRIC, and that an approach that accounted for migration would have yielded more than 70 cases. But by early 1999, the CDC team had virtually all the information it would ever get on autism rates in BRIC. What did they do with that information? They had two questions they really needed to address in any final report. The first was the issue of locally elevated environmental toxins, the kind of industrial contamination that might have provoked a BRIC autism cluster. The BRIC posse certainly believed that they had discovered a cluster, and so there was great concern over specific chemicals that might be harming BRIC's unborn children. Gallagher expressed skepticism that vaccines had anything to do with her own children's autism. "It's possible that vaccines are a factor in some families, but I don't think that's what happened with my two children," she told one of us. "I brought two autistic babies back from the hospital." So with the support of local parents, the CDC team focused on water quality, and they had a specific hypothesis about the nature of the contamination. Frank Bove, the CDC team member from the ATSDR, had written a paper just a few years before that linked trihalomethanes, THMs, to a variety of birth defects, including neural tube defects. Bove believed that these neural tube defects could be the missing piece in the puzzle. Bove consulted with Patricia Rodier, a researcher from Rochester, who had worked on toxins that she believed could cause neural tube defects in autism. The ATSDR report on BRIC went on at some length about their concerns over THMs and neural tube defects. But in Bove's particular approach to the analysis of Brick's autism cases and THM exposure, there was no smoking gun. In fact, any way they cut the data, they could find no link between the elevated THM rates in the local water supply and the local autism cases. In short, the ATSDR's quest for a singular environmental toxin that might provide an easy explanation for Brick's autism problem came up empty. So, despite autism rates in Brick that were far higher than anything ever seen before, the CDC and the ATSDR were unwilling to declare the Brick community an autism cluster. To this day, autism rates in New Jersey are among the highest in the nation and among the highest reported anywhere in the world. One recent survey reported a rate in New Jersey of 1 in 94 children. But partly because no obvious and easy toxin presented itself for blame and removal, the CDC took no position on Brick's high autism rates, and they pursued the issue no further. The second question on the CDC's plate was the rising trend in autism rates. In Gallagher's support group meeting in 1997, everyone had remarked on the unusually large numbers of 3 to 4 year old cases of autism. And by January 1999, the CDC had a great deal of data on ages and birth years of their affected population. Despite much evidence to the contrary, they declared that there was no statistical support for higher autism rates in younger children. Age-specific rates were calculated for preschool, 3 to 5 year old, and school-aged, 6 to 10 year old children. CIs, confidence intervals, for the two age groups overlapped, indicating that the prevalence rates for the two age groups were not different. How could this be true? It seemed to fly in the face of everything observed by the parents and professionals on the ground, not to mention the hints that the CDC had been hearing for years about rising autism rates all over the country. Unlike the search for environmental toxins in the water, there was nothing complicated about the trend. Either there were more cases, or there weren't. And if the rates were rising, however hard it might be to pin down the cause, it was important to keep looking because too many children were sick. In mid-2002, it occurred to another New Jersey mother, Sally Bernard, that the CDC's conclusion in their Brick Township report was likely to be flawed. Not only was the rising trend apparent in the CDC's data, there were also a number of odd elements in the report's design and write-up. For one thing, the age groupings were strange. The sample was separated into two groups of unequal size, 3 to 5 and 6 to 10 year olds. Why would they not divide the population into equal sizes, putting 3 to 6 year olds and 7 to 10 year olds together? For another, autism time trends can be easily misinterpreted if the analysts don't factor in the lag time that the youngest children face in getting recognized. The technical term is ascertainment bias. What if the Brick team, as most survey teams had done before them, had simply undercounted 3-year-olds? So Sally Bernard sent an email to Frank DiStefano of the CDC, whom she had met at a recent meeting. She asked him what would happen to the Brick rates with 3-year-old cases removed, and he responded in a May 10, 2002 email, "For overall ASD, the prevalences were 10.2 per 1,000 among children 4 to 6 years old, 4.4 per 1,000 among those 7 to 10 years old." Sally promptly thanked him, and, noticing that this rate differential seemed larger than the published study, asked him if these were statistically significant. DiStefano responded in detail that they were. "The results are based on 35 cases out of an estimated 3,442 children, 4 to 6 years of age, and 19 cases out of an estimated 4,272 children, 7 to 10 years of age. The difference in prevalences noted below is statistically significant." In other words, the published conclusion changed completely if you simply removed a single age group. the three-year-olds. Despite providing a stunning admission, DiStefano had still not given Sally what she really wanted, which was the breakdown by age category. So Sally asked him again. And a few months later, she received this response from Marshalin Jürgen Alsop. "Hi, Sally. Happy New Year. Frank DiStefano has asked me to respond to your question about rates of autistic disorder for Brick Township. They are, per thousand, rounded. 3-year-olds, 2.5. 4-year-olds, 6.1. 5-year-olds, 7.8. 6-year-olds, 7.0. 7-year-olds, 6.4. 8-year-olds, 2.0. 9-year-olds, blank. 10-year-olds, blank. Total, 4.0. This was even more of a shock. What Jürgen Alsop had revealed was that there was not a single case of full syndrome autism in the entire Brick Township population of 9 and 10-year-olds. While this was a different case definition than the one DiStefano had given, which included PDD-NOS and Asperger's cases, it provided clear statistical support for the concern over the unusual number of cases in the younger children. And here it was, in black and white. The CDC had had this data all along. So on the second crucial part of their charge, the evidence was clear. The CDC knew there was an autism epidemic in Brick Township in 1998, and they neither said nor did anything about it. In fact, they did exactly the opposite. They used a clever bit of statistical trickery to cover it up. In fact, once you have the real trend data, you can figure out how hard the CDC had to work in order to report a result that said there was no trend. In the months between their January 1999 press conference and their April 2000 report, the CDC had figured out the only possible way to claim that autism rates weren't rising. They took the 6 to 10-year-old group, in which autism rates went from zero in the group born in 1988, the 10-year-olds to 1 in 143 for the group born in 1992, the 6-year-olds, and put them in one bucket. They took the 3 to 5-year-old group, which due to ascertainment bias had a declining rate from 1 in 128 for children born in 1993 to 1 in 394 for the youngest children born in 1995, and put them into another bucket. And they compared these two ratios and reported that there was no significance to the rising trend. And if you run the statistics on just this arrangement of the data, they are correct. But virtually every other reasonable grouping shows a significant increase. DiStefano's analysis comparing ASD rates in 4 to 6-year-olds with 7 to 10-year-olds gave a significant increase with 99% confidence. Statistical significance kicks in at 95% confidence. If you take the full syndrome autism group and divide it into two equally sized buckets, comparing 3 to 6-year-olds and 7 to 10-year-olds, you also get a significant result with 99% confidence. If you take the 5 to 6-year-old group of full syndrome kids and compare it to the 9 to 10-year-old kids, you get an even more significant finding, more than 99.9% confidence. Pervasive developmental disorders is the diagnostic category often referred to as autism spectrum disorders. The three main categories of pervasive developmental disorder, PDD, include autistic disorders, PDD-NOS, not otherwise specified, and Asperger's syndrome. A diagnosis of PDD-NOS is similar to, but less severe than, autistic disorder, and includes language and communication delays, unlike Asperger's. If this wasn't a cover-up, it's hard to think of a polite synonym. Assuming the problem in Brick was more than a cluster, if there was a broader national trend toward rising autism rates, then what matters is not just the age of the BRIC children, but their birth years. A more consistent national trend would be revealed if we could find similar changes in autism rates in the same birth years. And a clear picture of the increasing trend would help us identify the potential environmental causes, aside from elevated local toxins in the BRIC water supply. The age groupings in the BRIC team's study were based on the attained age in 1998, so the ages are easily converted to birth years. Let's consider the data Jürgen Alsop sent to Sally Bernard and compare it to the data the CDC published. The rates exploded in the 1990 to 1994 birth years and then dropped off a bit in the 3-year-olds due to the ascertainment effect. Considering the numbers year by year and comparing them to the published rates, it's easy to see just how deceptive the CDC's report findings truly were. After such a diligent and responsive start, what moved the CDC team to do something like this? In March 1999, just 2 months after the CDC's first press conference on BRIC Township, the California Department of Developmental Services issued a report showing a sharp increase in the number of autism cases in California. A few months after that, in July 1999, the Public Health Service announced its plans to remove thimerosal from childhood vaccines. So as the team completed their work, it's almost certain that the public posture the CDC was deciding to take in the BRIC report took on added importance. After all, as the data shows, the real surge in BRIC was in line with the expansion in the required immunization program and certainly correlated with thimerosal exposure. So there's little doubt that the CDC was worried about its own role in provoking an autism epidemic. At the same time, as the durable evidence of elevated rates in New Jersey had shown, the local trend may also have been part of something more specific to the BRIC environment. This was a moment of choice for CDC, and in a moment that required continued professionalism, openness, and candor, something else happened. In April 2000, after many months of silence, Bobby Gallagher got a call from the CDC. They were coming to town to release their study. Both the CDC prevalence report and the ATSDR analysis of local toxins. They came to her house, gave her 2 lengthy documents, asked her to respond in the moment if she had any questions. They confessed that the autism rates in BRIC were 3 times higher than rates they were seeing elsewhere, but they had no plans to do anything more about it. Then they left Gallagher's house to go to the public meeting, where they took the same basic approach. They made no presentations, simply put the 2 reports on the table and made themselves available for questions. They had 2 sessions, one for the press and one for the residents. And at the front of the room, Gallagher reports, there were 2 groups of people. One was the familiar team who had done the work and been part of the initial outreach. Next to them was another group we had never seen before. Their job, according to Gallagher, was to watch the original group and make sure nobody said the wrong thing. At 8 o'clock p.m., the session ended, and you've never seen a group leave a room so fast. And we never heard from any of them ever again. In the midst of the AIDS epidemic, it was CDC researchers that took the lead, often against the intransigence and conservatism of National Institutes of Health, NIH, researchers, in tracking down the causes and taking steps to reduce its toll on society. For many years, the CDC was held up to the world as a model government agency. Yet in autism, there seems to have been a downward spiral, and many feel that the agency has been defensive, secretive, and non-responsive to a health crisis. There are undoubtedly larger forces affecting the agency and its leadership. But if there are turning points in the lives of large institutions, crossroads at which difficult choices are made, then the CDC's handling of the autism epidemic is certainly one such turning point. From Bones Follies. While the federal government managed to avoid coming to grips with the alarming increase in autism in Brick Township, even more startling evidence from figures compiled at the state level was already overtaking it. Data from California released in March 1999 showed a 273% increase in the number of new cases of autism entering California's developmental services system from 1987 through 1998. The actual cases jumped from 3,902 to 12,780, a rate of increase more than four times greater than those seen in other diagnostic categories like cerebral palsy, epilepsy, and mental retardation. But these California numbers came under sharp attack from a London psychiatrist, Eric Fambone. "There is no need to raise false alarms on putative epidemics," he wrote, "nor to practice poor science to draw the attention to the unmet needs of large numbers of seriously impaired children and adults." The assault on the California numbers had extra weight coming from Fambone, who had become one of the most prolific authors in the field of autism epidemiology. Fambone himself was not a trained epidemiologist, but a psychiatrist who had gotten into the field of autism by designing diagnostic tools and using those for prevalent surveys of autism. At the time the California report was released, no single author had published more surveys than Fambone. More to the point, he was also a prolific reviewer of the epidemiological literature. Starting in 1998, he wrote a series of review articles on autism, in which he collected and summarized findings from the past several decades of research in autism epidemiology. These were careful, meticulous comparisons of the differences and similarities in published autism surveys. Inevitably, in a review of the body of literature, the question of trend would arise, and Fambone took a position. There was no trend. In the early reviews, it was possible to justify this conclusion because in most of the studies before 1995, the rates were consistent and low, along the lines of Lotter's original survey of 4.1 per 10,000 in England, with the exception of a few higher reported rates in some Japanese surveys. But as time went on and the numbers began growing like a weed, Fambone appears to have dug in his heels to defend the orthodoxy that autism was a genetic disorder with constant prevalence. This required an attack on the California study, and he delivered. He said the diagnostic practices failed to account for increasing population. Their case definitions were inconsistent. Autistic children were being diagnosed earlier, and that a chart showing the rising number of cases was distorted. This graphical display deliberately transforms what is an age effect into what seems a cohort effect, Fambone argued. By analogy, any sample with a marked skewed age distribution, for example, take a survey of Army personnel, could be misleadingly portrayed by replacing age by year of birth and giving the same impression of an upward trend over time. But nobody would interpret the transformed personnel Army data as indicative of rising numbers of militaries. At the most basic level, Fambone's aggressive attack was flawed and assumed that age effects could be separated from cohort effects. He failed to consider the notion that the Army has a thing called discharge. There may be a parallel in autism, the kind of recovery we saw when Donald Trippett was treated with gold salts, but by no means more than 10%. In the vast majority of autism cases, after they are enlisted, there is no discharge. In 2002, a follow-up study by the MIND Institute at the University of California, Davis, showed that Fambone's objections were baseless, that the increase was stark and real. The study concluded, "The observed increase in autism cases cannot be explained by a loosening in the criteria used to make the diagnosis. Some children reported by the regional centers with mental retardation and not autism did meet criteria for autism. But this misclassification does not appear to have changed over time. Children served by the state's regional centers are largely native-born, and there has been no major migration of children into California that would explain the increase in autism. The next year, a study that adjusted for population also found rising rates of full syndrome autism, not including the broad spectrum of other varieties, of more than 30 per 10,000, close to the Brick Township rates. Still, there were many attempts to nullify the California numbers and other signs of a huge increase, most of them based on the idea of diagnostic substitution, that autism rates were rising because more cases were being recognized that had once been classified under other diagnostic categories, such as mental retardation. One study led by Lisa Crowan appeared to show exactly that, and drew praise from Fombone in the Journal of Autism and Developmental Disorders. Crowan et al. Carefully analyzed the California dataset from the Department of Developmental Services, Fombone wrote. Looking at factors that might explain the increase of prevalence reported during the 1987 to 1994 period, he summarized the basic case for diagnostic substitution. The findings indicate that the administrative prevalence of autism increased during the study period, but that the increase in the rate of autism was paralleled by an almost identical decrease in the rate of mental retardation not associated with autism. Fombone's conclusions about Crowan's analysis were flatly wrong. One of us reviewed the study and identified basic errors in Crowan's analysis, particularly the tendency we've seen in the Brick Township numbers for the ascertainment levels to fall off sharply in children under 5 years of age. 2- and 3-year-old children with autism are far more frequently overlooked during screening efforts. This is true for both autism and mental retardation. Correcting for this bias dramatically changed the results that Crowan reported. When challenged with this criticism, Crowan and colleagues looked at the data again, were forced to acknowledge that the criticism was correct, and retracted their original analysis. The diagnostic substitution argument has since been tried out on many occasions, but two studies using special education data, one in Minnesota and another using data for the entire United States, found no evidence supporting this speculation. The Minnesota analysts found that prevalence rates were not falling in other special education categories, while at the same time they observed sharp increases in autism rates. In the nationwide analysis, a different analyst group found no evidence of substitution at the national level when comparing autism to its closest diagnostic neighbors. Mental retardation and speech, language impairment. In 2003, another group of investigators examined trends in autism rates in the United Kingdom, observing an increase in autism rates, while comparing this trend to what they suggested was a declining trend in rates of certain developmental disorders. In our view, the authors of the study offered the clear inference that the increased rates of autism were a result of diagnostic substitution. But the analysis also suffered from serious errors, some of which the authors subsequently acknowledged, even as they disavowed having raised the idea of diagnostic substitution at all. Then, in 2005, a group from the Mayo Clinic examined the possibility of diagnostic substitution in a population in Olmsted County, Minnesota. They found no evidence of substitution between diagnostic categories, since both autism rates and rates of possible substitute disorders increased during the study period. In light of this, the group was forced to concede, "We cannot exclude the possibility that environmental factors caused this increase. Additional studies are needed to address this possibility." This was a crucial point, yet these observations were buried in the detail of the report, and the authors downplayed this concession in the short abstract that summarized the results of their analysis. Besides diagnostic substitution, two additional arguments have been proposed to explain the rising numbers. The first was diagnostic expansion. In other words, the suggestion that the criteria themselves changed, and other kinds of disorders that had not been included in the autism spectrum before were now being included in the numbers. This contention is true, in a sense, but only in the narrowest of ways. In 1994, Asperger's syndrome was specifically included in the fourth edition of the DSM as part of the Pervasive Developmental Disorders, PDDs. Most careful surveys of autism prevalence rates take care to distinguish between the three main categories of PDDs: PDD Autistic Disorder, PDD Not Otherwise Specified, PDD-NOS, and PDD Asperger's Syndrome. In fact, Asperger's Syndrome was rarely included in autism surveys published until very recently. In most such surveys, the researchers provided a clear distinction between the Asperger's cases and the other PDDs. In those cases in which Asperger's syndrome data were reported, the numbers represented less than 20% of the total, and in all the surveys in which apples-to-apples comparisons can be made, the upward trend in autism is clear. It's only been the studies designed by the CDC itself in which enough confusion has come into play to make the claim of diagnostic expansion remotely credible. The CDC's formal autism surveillance program is called the Autism and Developmental Disabilities Monitoring Network, or ADDM. The program began measuring birth cohorts from 1992, therefore excluding by design the birth years with lower rates. And ADDM's reported statistics include all PDDs under autism, including Asperger's syndrome, with no segmentation between subcategories. Regardless of this confusion, there's plenty of evidence from the broader autism survey literature that full syndrome autism rates, PDD, autistic disorder, have risen by a factor of 10 or more, with no contribution at all from Asperger's cases. Two other perspectives provide evidence refuting the hypothesis of diagnostic expansion. First, by simply looking back at their stated goals, the clear intention of the group that designed the latest set of diagnostic criteria for the PDDs is clear. The change from DSM-3, 1980, to DSM-3-R, 1987, is an example of the broadening of the concept of autism, states Fred Volkmar, a leader of the design team for the most recent criteria. By contrast, from DSM-3R to DSM-4, 1994, a corrective narrowing occurred. Emphasis added. Despite the efforts of the designers to tighten the standard, the numbers exploded anyway. Second, by looking back at actual diagnostic practices, the only group to perform an audit of diagnosis quality over time found an equally clear result. In comparing two birth cohorts with diagnoses separated by a decade in California, they concluded there was no evidence that loosening in diagnostic criteria contributed to an increase in the number of children with autism. The final epidemic denial argument, in addition to diagnostic substitution and diagnostic expansion, is one that instead posits a widespread and systematic pattern of diagnostic oversight. One of us previously labeled this theory the hidden hoard hypothesis, the suggestion that somewhere out there are hundreds of thousands of adults and older children with a diagnosis of autism whose condition previously eluded detection and have gone through life underserved and undiagnosed. Besides the logical impossibility of this hypothesis, a number of investigators have searched for this hidden hoard and failed to locate one. In two instances, research groups went back to populations in which low autism prevalence rates had been measured previously and looked for new cases. In one of these, a North Dakota group found that 98% of cases had been found in their first survey, while in the other, no new cases were found in a 1975 to 1977 Swedish birth cohort after adjustments for immigration. Using a different approach, two studies have sought to find undiagnosed autistic individuals in adult psychiatric outpatient settings. In each investigation, one in Taiwan, another in Sweden, the rate of undiagnosed autistic cases was low, less than 3 per 10,000 in the population, and only a small percentage of the outpatient groups that were examined, less than 1%. Most recently, a group of researchers at the Mayo Clinic developed an aggressive method to reclassify as autistic older individuals never diagnosed with autistic disorder. They described these as research-identified autism cases. In their earliest cohort, their method routinely designated teenagers as autistic without regard to age at onset of symptoms. One of four essential criteria for autistic disorder. Despite this search for overlooked cases, the authors found that autism rates increased by more than 8 times in a 15-year period. But consider for a moment a common-sense test of the hidden hoard hypothesis. By one estimate, in the history of mankind, well over 100 billion people have been born on Earth, 99 billion of them before 1930. If autism rates were truly 1 in 150 throughout that period, then we would expect to have seen close to 700 million autistic people born before Leo Kanner's first case in 1931. Yet, try as we might, we find no mention of these people in the history books, in literature, in folklore, or in family records of any kind. How could this many cases go unnoticed and unrecognized for so long? How could this many severely ill people have remained hidden, much less functioned adequately, without help for so many years? How could Leo Kanner have described with a straight face a condition that differed markedly and uniquely from anything reported so far, if they had been present in the hundreds of millions before? It is true some modest forces are helping to fill out the case numbers in some reports. There's probably some shift toward an earlier age of diagnosis due to more active screening, and this earlier diagnosis can limit the ascertainment effect we've described before and speed up the rate at which true cases of autism can enter a services system. There are certainly more administrative databases to register formal autism diagnoses as part of an official record, and this expansion of registration practices provides more systematic reporting of prevalence rates without the need for special survey projects. But none of these forces come even remotely close to explaining the dramatic increases we've seen in reported autism rates. The reason reported rates are higher is because the real rate is higher. Some may find it hard to accept, but the truth is inescapable. Something new and terrible is happening to a generation of children. Meanwhile, more anomalies have offered clues not only to the rising rate, but to the reasons behind it. Out of Africa and the Amish. As if on cue, the latest autism tragedy emerged in the Somali community of Minnesota. Escaping the horrors of a civil war that has lasted nearly 2 decades, these families immigrated to the United States in large numbers, looking to replace their nightmare with the American dream. The rapidly evolving Somali experience is unfolding in familiar form, first with their own rising awareness of the autism anomaly, as inexplicably high numbers of autism diagnoses show up in their children, followed closely with organized denial by public health authorities of both the rising numbers and the potential causes. As we noted earlier, autism has always been rare in Africa, with low rates that have surprised researchers. Most autism there occurred in what was termed elite families with access to Western health services. Now, among Africans who migrate to Western countries, autism rates are remarkably high. This raises an interesting set of questions. The obvious risk that immigrants to any Western country face is over-vaccination. As vaccination programs have spread around the world in recent years, future immigrants are increasingly likely to be vaccinated in their home countries. When they travel, they are forced to receive another round of vaccinations in their home countries before they leave. When they reach their new countries, their previous vaccination records are generally not recognized as valid, and they often must be vaccinated again. This unique migration risk is especially relevant for population groups that can influence autism risk: women of childbearing age, pregnant women, and infants. It's hard to know what kind of havoc these redundant treatments wreak on the immune system of such targets when they receive excessive vaccine doses. All we know is that children of modern immigrants are at high risk of both over-vaccination and of autism. But no one has ever bothered to investigate over-vaccination as a specific risk factor of obtaining the medical entry visa to Western civilization. Well before the Somali anomaly in Minnesota, autism surveys noted an increased risk of autism among African immigrants. The first hint came not from Minnesota, but from Sweden. In 1991, Christopher Gilberg, one of the more prolific autism survey authors, published a study titled, "Is Autism More Common Now Than 10 Years Ago?" in which he made the following observation about the city of Göteborg. Almost 60% of all new children with autism in the urban region detected between 1984 and 1988 were born to immigrant parents. Almost all of these parents had been born in non-neighboring countries, and more than half came from Southern Europe, Asia, Africa, and South America. So far, this represents an unusual distribution of immigrants as compared with the Göteborg population in general. In subsequent studies, Gilberg went on to investigate the idea that children born to parents of immigrants in Sweden, including but not limited to African immigrants, had higher autism risk. But Gilberg didn't consider the vaccination risk in any of these papers. Instead, he raised for the first time the notion that men with Asperger syndrome, whose children would be more likely than others to develop autism, might marry women from other cultures who, in turn, might not initially be as aware of the social and communication deficits shown by these men as native women would be. But in a detailed study of these specific cases, Gilberg rejected the parental mating theory. He did consider the idea that the Ugandan mothers were exposed to a novel virus while pregnant, and that this exposure provoked autism in their children. The suggestion that the virus might come from a vaccine rather than a wild type of virus never came up. Only recently has Gilberg even raised the specter of the vaccination hypothesis, this time indirectly in a 2008 analysis of Somali immigrants in Stockholm. Most important, this new study found a rate of autism among Somali immigrant families, 1 in 142, that was 3 to 4 times higher than the rate in the non-Somali group from Stockholm, 1 in 526. In their paper, the authors noted that the Stockholm Somali community was suspicious of the MMR vaccine and had a reduced vaccination compliance rate, 70% versus 95% in most other areas of Stockholm. They also noted that they had collected extensive medical records for all the Somali immigrants. But despite collecting all the information on Somali vaccine records, they did not disclose any vaccination risk analysis of any kind in the paper. By now, the official response that the Somali community in Minnesota experienced is predictable. Autism rates can't be low in Africa. We simply don't know what the prevalence is. When higher rates of autism showed up in the children of African women who immigrated, certainly it wasn't the experience these women had while immigrating that could shed light on their infants' risks. it must have been due to the innate autistic features of their husbands. And, of course, when the Somali community in Minnesota began to mobilize around the possibility that the excessive rate of vaccination to which they'd been subjected during their immigration process might have increased their children's risk of autism, they were dismissed with the same contempt with which native-born parents have been treated. But the findings speak for themselves. Lauter found 1 in 145 cases of autism in a population of mentally handicapped children in Africa. By contrast, in Somalian immigrants in Minnesota, we are finding 1 in 28 in the entire population of children. The Somali anomaly is no anomaly at all. Instead, it is a bright beacon that shines an uncomfortable light on the root causes of autism. As interesting as clusters with high autism rates might be, groups that appear to have a low prevalence of autism are also highly significant. Starting in 2005, one of us began looking for autism in major Amish population centers. There are just a few of them in the United States, with an overall population of close to 200,000 Amish, over two-thirds of whom reside in three states. If we had applied a recent estimate for autism prevalence of 1 in 150, we would have expected to find quite a large autistic population among the Amish, well over 1,000. But so far have identified only a small handful of cases, a minute fraction of the autism population size one would expect to find. The most aggressive possible count of autistic Amish comes to fewer than 20 cases, which would give us a rate of no more than 1 in 10,000, nearly 100 times less than the best current estimates. Dr. Heng Wang, director of the Clinic for Special Needs Children in Ohio, told us the rate of autism in the Amish there was 1 in 15,000. Literally. Of 15,000 Amish who live near Middlefield, Ohio, Wang is aware of just one who has autism. The consensus over low autism rates in the Amish population is as true in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, as it is in Middlefield. A Lancaster County doctor named Frank Noonan, who has cared for thousands of Amish patients over nearly 25 years, confirmed the same assessment. "We're right in the heart of Amish country, and seeing none," said Dr. Noonan. "And that's just the way it is." One medical center, the Clinic for Special Children in Lancaster County, says it does see Amish autistic children, but only in connection with genetic disorders. A pediatrician there, Kevin Strauss, described the cases as syndromic, occurring along with genetic defects, as opposed to idiopathic autism, with no evident organic or genetic anomalies. He told a blog writer, "We see autistic behaviors along with seizure disorders or mental retardation, or a genetic disorder, where the autism is part of a more complicated clinical spectrum, such as mental retardation, chromosomal abnormalities, unusual facial features, and short stature, as well as Fragile X syndrome. We see quite a few Amish children with Fragile X," he said. Strauss says he doesn't see cases of idiopathic autism, children with average or above-average IQs who display autistic behavior, at the clinic. "My personal experience is we don't see a lot of Amish children with idiopathic autism. It doesn't mean they don't exist, only that we aren't seeing them at the clinic." All of this suggests that autism, as it presents in mainstream American society, is markedly absent among the Amish. In interviews with dozens of Amish residents and those who serve them, we came across a single Amish child who met the description of idiopathic autism. The exception that could prove the rule. A decade ago, as an infant, she was taken from her family by public health authorities who did not approve of alternative treatments she was given to treat an ear infection. While in their care, she was vaccinated at the clinic for special children before being returned to her family a year later. At that point, the family said, they first noticed autistic behaviors. She now has a diagnosis of full syndrome autism. Like Native Americans without general paresis, the Amish are living a different lifestyle. They grow much of their own food, often give birth to their children at home, work in Amish-owned enterprises like furniture building, and make far less use of mainstream medicine. Although there is no prohibition against medical interventions, their vaccination rate tends to be lower and slower, and many Amish have never been vaccinated. After a 1991 rubella outbreak led to cases of congenital rubella syndrome, the CDC studied 89 mothers and found that only one had received a rubella vaccination. The rate of immunization has been rising as public health workers go door to door offering free vaccinations, but the overall coverage remains substantially lower. Some have suggested that because the Amish intermarry, they may be genetically protected from autism susceptibility genes. But it is far more likely that some environmental factor is at work. Former CDC Director Dr. Julie Gerberding has said that studies of the autism rate in never-vaccinated American children could be done and should be done. But to date, that has not happened. U.S. Representative Carolyn Maloney, Democrat of New York, has introduced and reintroduced a bill requiring the federal government to conduct such a study, informally referred to as the Amish Bill. Autism appears rare in two other settings with different lifestyles and lower vaccination rates: homeschooled children, many of whom are not vaccinated, and patients who choose health care practices such as Home First Health Services in Chicago, which does not push vaccines for families that don't want them. Dr. Jeff Bradstreet, who treats several thousand autistic children from around the country at his practice in Florida, said there is virtually no autism in homeschooling families who decline to vaccinate for religious reasons. "It's largely non-existent," Bradstreet told us. "It's an extremely rare event." Bradstreet, who describes himself as a Christian family physician, has a son whose autism he attributes to a vaccine reaction at 15 months. His daughter has been homeschooled, and he knows many of the leaders in the homeschooling movement. "There was this whole subculture of folks who went into homeschooling so they would never have to vaccinate their kids," he said. "There's this whole cadre who were never vaccinated for religious reasons. In that subset, unless they were massively exposed to mercury through lots of amalgams, mercury dental fillings in the mother, and or big-time fish eating, I've not had a single case." Home First Health Services in Chicago also says it has a virtual absence of autism among several thousand patients who were delivered at home by the practice. "In a group that size, there should be several dozen. Our practice has virtually no autism," the director, Dr. Mayer Eisenstein, reports. "I got all my partners together. We scoured the records. We looked at ICD codes for neurological disorders, and first of all, we didn't see it." "But it's more than just no autism," he said. He and his three partners, in practice for 25 years, decided at the beginning not to treat children with asthma and insulin-dependent diabetes. They would instead refer them to specialized practices. Asthma now afflicts 1 in 10 American children, and a growing number are diabetic. But neither diagnosis has occurred in the thousands of never-vaccinated children in the practice who were delivered at home. "And I can tell you this would be a nightmare when you have to start referring one person a week, 2 people a week, 3 people a week in a large practice, only because, you know," they would say, "but Dr. Eisenstein, I want you to take care of me." And I would have to say, "No, there are people who are much better at taking care of asthma than me. There's people who are much better at diabetes than me." But according to Eisenstein, it never came up. Separated at birth. As evidence for environmental factors increases, the twin studies that form the basis for the genetic argument have continued to look shakier. In the 10 years since the last twin study in Britain, there has been remarkably little published in terms of concordance studies. But more data about twins and autism have continued to come in, and they tend not to support the orthodox view of a genetic basis for autism. There are several ways in which the evidence refuses to cooperate with the theory. First, as we've noted, some authors have emphasized the high concordance rates in identical twins, rates that were 90% or above. But more accurate analyses of identical twin concordance rates come in at 70% and often lower. For example, a 2004 study found an identical twin concordance rate of only 44%, and a study in California produced a rate that could be as low as 59%. Second, there's a fair amount of evidence suggesting that even when the identical twin concordance rate is high, that's simply because twins themselves are at a higher risk for autism, including fraternal twins. The reasons for this aren't known, but might have something to do with the unusual gestational environment facing twins. This is an obvious conclusion to draw from the Ritvo study, which had an astonishingly high rate of fraternal concordance. The only concordance study done in the last 15 years came out of Japan and reports results that echo Ritvo, close to 100% concordance in identical twins, but close to 30% in fraternal twins. This may reflect an increased genetic susceptibility in the identical twins, but it may also point to their more often sharing an environment than do fraternal twins. Three other studies have suggested that high rates of autism in twins may simply result from the extra demands that twins put on mothers and babies in pregnancy, implying that being a twin is a risk factor for autism all by itself. Third, the idea that autism is inherited relies on the difference between the identical twin and the fraternal twin concordance rates, based on the idea that identical twins have identical DNA, and the higher the ratio between the two concordance rates, the more inheritance plays a role. The lower the ratio, the less convincing the case. The Japanese study, for example, with a high rate of concordance in identical twins, still has a ratio of identical to fraternal of only 3-1. Another study reported an identical to fraternal rate of less than 2-1, although they did so as a parenthetical aside. In short, the quest to confirm the heritability theory with the twin data is a numbers game and requires good behavior from the twin study data. Overwhelmingly, the data suggests that there are much more subtle interpretations of the twin evidence, none of which rely exclusively on genetics. In contrast to the numbers game of the orthodox geneticists, the case for the environmental perspective requires a different approach to evaluating the twin experience. From an environmental perspective, a high rate of fraternal twin concordance, much higher than any reasonable sibling rate, would be an occasion to inquire about the exposure history of the mothers and the affected twin pair because of their shared prenatal environment. Similarly, a low concordance rate in an identical twin provides an opportunity to learn what differed for the two children, who, despite sharing genetic material, have dramatically different outcomes. In our research, we've come across at least 8 such identical twin pairs with dramatically different outcomes. It is worth listening to 3 of the mothers tell their own stories. Gina and Daryl Smith of Baton Rouge had identical twins, Jesse and Jacob, in 1995. The only difference in their health history was that a month after the births, we found dark blood mixed in Jacob's diarrhea, Gina told a congressional hearing in 2000. Jacob had never had diarrhea before. We immediately took him to the doctor, who assured us the blood was from a rectal tear. He mentioned that, in the chaos that generally follows the birth of a baby, much less twins, we had been released from the hospital without vaccinating the twins with hepatitis B. He wanted to vaccinate Jacob right then. We questioned him because it did not seem right to give a potentially ill child a vaccine, but he convinced us that it was routine and safe, not to worry. Gina Smith believes that was the decisive difference. 2 months later, Jacob received his second hepatitis B vaccine, and Jesse his first. On this same day, Jacob and Jesse both received their first DPT, polio, and HIB vaccination. From that day, Jacob was constantly coming down with one ear, respiratory, or sinus infection after another. Jacob was constantly on antibiotics. At only 16 months of age, Jacob and Jesse received their first MMR vaccine, along with their fourth DPT, fourth HIB, and their third hepatitis B. The following 24 hours, both twins slept most of the time with 100-degree temperatures, in spite of receiving the recommended dosage of Tylenol every 6 hours. Just days later, Jacob began exhibiting strange behaviors. He was no longer excited or responsive when Daddy came home from work. He became preoccupied with certain toys. He would spend long periods of time studying the way their wheels would spin, or whether or not they were lined up just right. Any attempt to interrupt or distract him was met with great resistance and an eventual fit. During this time, Jesse went along with business as usual. Back to the doctor we went again, this time with very serious concerns about the growing developmental difference between Jesse and Jacob. And once again, we were met with the dominant twin theory. Jacob would probably be more quiet. Jacob would probably want to play by himself more often. Jacob is fine, stop worrying. Finally, we could not stand the undeniable difference in their language and communication skills. Something was most definitely wrong with Jacob. He could not express even his most simple needs or wants. He couldn't ask for juice or something to eat. Jesse was chattering constantly, and at times, Jacob was so withdrawn that we absolutely could not reach him. In a waiting room, in front of several other parents, we received Jacob's first official diagnosis. The director of LSU's speech and hearing clinic callously and simply stated, "Mrs. Smith, Jacob is autistic." Diane Powell of Harrisburg gave birth on November 25, 2000, 14 weeks prematurely. Casey was 13.8 ounces, one of the smallest premature infants ever to survive. Identical twin Sean was 1 pound, 7 ounces. Casey was diagnosed at 2.5 with classic autism. He had been developmentally delayed since birth, but did have regression, loss of speech and eye contact. Diane Powell says, "He remains nonverbal, makes sounds and some word approximations, still hand flaps, stims, etc. He's affectionate, but still has a diagnosis of classic autism." Sean was tracked for developmental delay due to prematurity early on and received speech and OT. At 8, he is now in a regular school class with no special support or services. Certainly, I think genetics plays a role, but not the only role, since we disprove this, their mother says. Casey was and is still the most immune-compromised of the two. He has also been diagnosed with PANDAS, so his immune system is all out of whack, and has been since birth. In the neonatal intensive care unit, he had a staph infection and pneumonia, among other problems, and later, tons of ear infections. One of the strongest tests of heredity versus environment is the separated-at-birth phenomenon. That is what happened to the identical twin boys of Kim Stewart. When I was 19 and in college in Massachusetts, I got pregnant. My first ultrasound revealed I was carrying twins. After weighing my options, along with the baby's father, my boyfriend at the time, we decided on adoption. I gave birth to two healthy, identical twin boys. I had hoped that the boys could be kept together, but in the end they were adopted by two different families, one in Nashua, New Hampshire, Kevin, and one in Portland, Maine, Brian. The families kept in touch with each other and also sent me periodic updates. Both boys were developing normally and were healthy, happy little boys. At 15 months, Kevin began regressing and losing skills and was diagnosed with severe autism at age 2. Brian continued to develop normally. At the time, the vaccine question never came up, and I wasn't aware of the vaccine status of the boys. I just assumed they were both vaccinated because that's what everyone did. When the boys were six, a friend had a severe reaction to a flu shot while pregnant, and subsequently gave birth to a baby girl, who was also vaccinated with Hep B at birth, against my friend's wishes, who never developed normally and was diagnosed with early infantile autism. This caused me to wonder about what might have happened to Kevin, and I discovered that his initial regression coincided with his 15-month shots. Brian's family are Christian Scientists and did not vaccinate him. Obviously, there can be other factors involved, since they live in different places and are exposed to different things. But after what happened to my friend's daughter, I became convinced that Kevin's vaccinations played a significant role in his regression. Additionally, Kevin has gut problems and food and environmental allergies, while Brian does not. The boys will be 15 next week. I am now married with three daughters. Interestingly, I had another set of identical twins, who are now five, and I also have a two-year-old. None of them are vaccinated, and they are all incredibly healthy and vibrant kids. Scientific Revolution. The incidence of autism is increasing at disturbing rates, yet this simple observation, affirmed by clinicians, parents, educational providers, and a wide range of front-line professionals, has been surprisingly controversial. Leading news journals hesitate to report it. Leading scientists carry on in their research without considering the implications of the increase. And most of the epidemiologists who have taken on the special challenges of analyzing and interpreting what little data exists on the incidence of autism have sidestepped this critical issue. Why is there such resistance to such a simple finding of fact? Because, in the language of historians of science, rising autism incidence is an anomaly, a novelty that the prevailing model of the disease cannot explain. Anomalies are often unwelcome events in the regular course of scientific progress. But when such events occur in the context of a community struggle, they can be even more unwelcome. And indeed, over the last few decades, there has been a meaningful struggle to establish a medical model for autism, a disease that was once thought to result from the pathological neglect of so-called refrigerator mothers. In the context of such a recent struggle, the emergence of an anomalous finding has met with more than its usual share of scientific skepticism. Yet, the alarming rates of autism have continued to attract widespread publicity and attention. In the meantime, the prevailing disease model continues its collapse in the face of novel information it cannot explain. Specifically, the soaring autism rates in the United States and Britain starting around 1990 that many parents associate with the rise in vaccinations. And it is the parents and a vanguard of courageous scientists who are putting together the puzzle pieces and building a new environmental paradigm for the disorder.